Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is disaster resilience in the Bay Area. No strangers to national disasters, Bay Area citizens have long been pioneering ways to rebound from earthquakes, floods, droughts, and fires. From the 1906 earthquake and fire that destroyed 80% of the city, to the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake that caused an estimated $6 billion in property damage, the Bay Area has faced some of the most destructive disasters in American history. Today, we are challenged by hazards both old and new. Experts predict a 67% chance of another major earthquake in the next 25 years, and climate change threatens to worsen the effects of floods and droughts. Through the experiences of 1906 and 1989, improved building codes, hazard mapping, and awareness efforts have made us more disaster-ready than ever before. The unique situation of the Bay Area recently led the Rockefeller Foundation to hail San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland as three of the first winners of its Resilient Cities Challenge. As a result, three cities are receiving funds to increase their ability to prepare for natural disasters. Earlier this year, San Francisco used its prize money to hire the world's first chief resilience officer, who coordinates various resiliency efforts throughout the city. But what does it mean to call ourselves resilient? And should we be doing more? How can we develop well-prepared neighborhoods within a resilient city? What does it take to create buildings that can withstand earthquakes? And how can architecture advance our idea of what resilience means? How can we prepare for the effects that climate change may have on the severity of natural disasters? Tonight, we take a look at some innovative ways the Bay Area is adapting not just to survive, but to prosper in the wake of natural disaster, and how preparedness goes beyond your everyday earthquake kit. Joining me in studio to discuss these ideas are Daniel Holmesy, director of the Neighborhood Empowerment Network, which helps San Francisco neighborhoods steward themselves to a resilient condition. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
Mary Camario, professor at UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, where she specializes in seismic rehabilitation, disaster recovery, and loss modeling. She is also the author of Disaster Hits Home, New Policy for Urban Housing Recovery. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
And Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director at SPUR, where she specializes in climate change and water management. Welcome, Laura.
Great to be here.
In a few minutes, we'll invite you, our listeners, to call in to join our conversation. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Let's get right into it. Resilience is a big buzzword now in disaster management. How do you define resilience? Let's start with you, Daniel.
It is we were just talking earlier about how it's as if the word was just created. And the truth is that resilience has actually been a term that has been a common phrase or status that people have used for centuries about themselves and their communities. And I think that today resilience is coming out under the construct of the great immense lens that's being pointed at the kind of stress that residents of cities and communities around the world are experiencing now. Some have had long histories of events, such as in Japan, its long history of tsunamis and earthquakes, and then relatively new situations, such as the Hurricane Sandy situation, a Superstorm Sandy in New York City. So for me, I think resilience falls back into the classic narrative, which is like, are you able to bounce back? Are you able to negotiate times of stress and return at least to a condition that you self-identify you're proud of, or perhaps achieve a better condition? And some might point to San Francisco's efforts to reevaluate the role of the freeway system it had in place before 1989, and now looking back saying, well, the earthquake actually allowed us to achieve a better condition by removing them. So it really comes down to the nuances of what entity you're talking about and the kind of stressor they're dealing with.
Mary, how do you define it?
Well, I would add, I mean, it's true that the concept has been with us for centuries, but there are some technical definitions that are quite important, and there are two. One is an engineering definition, which says something receives a shock and comes back to where it was before. So that's a standard way that engineers think about design. You want to have the bridge move and come back to where it was before. You don't want it to fail. But there's also an ecological definition, and it was really 40 or 50 years ago put forward by a man named C.S. Hollings. And that has more of this quality of adapting and moving forward and changing, so that the idea isn't just to come back to where you were, but to actually come back stronger, better, go forward, adapt to the new circumstances. And so I think
Daniel's example of the freeway coming down, and then now we have a beautiful ferry building and the whole waterfront down there.
Exactly. And I think that that has influenced the kind of current understanding of resilience. It's changed the way engineers are thinking about resilience. Mm-hmm. So that ecological sort of proposition has been hugely important over the last 40 or 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Laura Tam, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I come from that field of environmental science and thinking that thinks about resilience as the capacity of a system to sort of self-organize and self-manage in spite of sort of shocks or stressors to its system. So in that way, applying it to the infrastructure world and the urban world, I think that it's got a couple of other components besides those that Mary and Daniel have so articulately framed, which is the ability to sort of bounce back from any kind of disaster that faces it, and that happens in a couple of ways. So my definition sort of includes what that means, which is thinking about a system as like asking the question, how vulnerable is this system to handling a change? How likely is it to experience that change? And how can it manage, how capable is it of managing that change when it happens and still maintaining its essential qualities? So I guess those things seem to me to sort of add a little flavor to the definition of what it really means.
Okay, so we obviously know about earthquakes here in the Bay Area. Other than earthquakes, what are the other natural disasters that folks worry about?
Well, go ahead, Mary.
Well, the ones we should be worrying about are fire, sea level rise. We don't have a lot of flooding in San Francisco, but we could have it in low-lying areas, certainly in the Bay Area, in the region.
Sure.
So all of those things are really part of our disaster profile.
I would also just add, considering the work that we do, especially surrounding the station here in the Bayview neighborhood, is there's also another threshold of disasters, and those are when they're hyper-local. And we see those throughout the city. For example, the urban flooding. I helped respond to the flooding in the Cayuga district here of San Francisco one year, where it was just a four-block area, but you know, it was under 5 feet of water for 30 minutes, and it caused a tremendous amount of negative impact on that community. For people around the city, it didn't make the news, perhaps, but for those folks, it did. And then you even look at the problem we have right now with residential fires in San Francisco. If we have a multi-unit building that catches fire, which happens, unfortunately, in this area frequently, those folks that are impacted by that often have to leave the region because they can't secure housing anywhere else. So sometimes what we find is that these small events at the neighborhood level actually better prepare communities to bounce back against the larger events. So I would offer that as being one way to look at those challenges.
How does resilience mean different things to different communities in San Francisco?
Well, I think that's interesting. One of the things that we try and do is, when we engage a community and start talking about resilience, the first thing we do is ask them, describe what you feel your goals and priorities are if you were to face a stressor of any kind. I want to add to the list that was put out there that a really big common threat that we have here in San Francisco that is escalating now are heat waves. This is actually a very lethal condition. San Francisco, and I think David might be interested in digging a little bit, like, why are heat waves such a big issue in San Francisco? It's because the built environment in San Francisco was built for a San Francisco that's 80 years ago. San Francisco is getting hotter. The buildings that we built that a lot of residents live in don't have air conditioning in them. So when things heat up, after 2 or 3 days, there is no respite. And a lot of residents in San Francisco are acclimated to 62 degrees, like myself. And technically, a heat wave in San Francisco is 85 degrees. And so this is one of the neat things about San Francisco is that we actually go into neighborhoods and show them NASA maps of where the heat index is for their community. And people living 6 blocks apart can have very different experiences under these stressors. And so that's the beginning of the conversation, is to let them understand what they are, let them set their goals for what they believe they want to perform during those times of stress. And inversely, that's often where their definition of resilience comes from.
Yeah, I would just to add to that, I mean, some of these things that we experience, that we hear about with respect to climate change, may only get more severe, more frequent, and of longer duration in the future, such as the heat waves that Daniel points to. We did a study a couple years ago that looked at vulnerability of the Bay Area to future impacts of climate change and found that, paradoxically, unlike what most people expect, just as Daniel said, we actually have a high heat vulnerability in San Francisco and Alameda counties, more so than many objectively hotter places in California and across the country, because we're so underprepared for it.
Our infrastructure
exactly.
is not prepared for it, right?
And I would just say to your previous question about other natural disasters, we're in the middle of one. I don't know how natural it is, actually. It might quite be actually an unnatural disaster, but we're in the middle of one right now, which is this severe drought, which
sure.
some are saying is we have a likelihood of having a 50-80% chance of a drought of 10 years or longer still at this time, even after it rained in December. So a lot of drought, fire, heat waves, sea level rise of 3 feet by the end of the century and at least a foot by the middle of the century. All of these things add up to quite a suite of unnatural disasters, in fact, that we have to be prepared for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Daniel, how do cities prepare for this myriad of possible negative events with the budget crisis and everything that have been hitting city budgets? Obviously, things are a little better now, but it's very hard to say, oh, yeah, in the next 30 years, there's a 60% chance of this. I mean, earthquakes in San Francisco, mm-hmm. people are pretty prepared for. But some of the other things, Mary, you were alluding to this, you hope people are preparing, but really it isn't on their mind. How do you get both at a governmental level the resources and the commitment to think about these things, and then at a neighborhood level mm-hmm. to get people just, you know, trying to go to work and be with their kids and go about their regular lives? They don't want to think about this stuff.
Well, I think, you know, I think going back to the definition of resilience, I would also offer, like, what category does resilience fall into? And I think it falls into the behavior category. Either you behave in a resilient manner or you don't. I think it's a very difficult thing for cities to come from a cold start and jump into a massive resilience investment strategy. We were talking earlier about the city of Portland. The city of Portland has, you know, to some extent, just realize that they are actually sitting on a subduction fault zone, which is equivalent to what they have in Tohoku, Japan. And they look around their city and they realize they have done very little investment from a mitigation standpoint into the buildings, into the systems that everyone relies on, like the bridges in Portland, for example. So for them to jumpstart a resilience investment strategy would be significant financially. Here in San Francisco, we've been really blessed, strangely, to have, like, you know, the lore of 1906, which we all can look back through some spur reports and see how the city civic leaders used the earthquake to get Hetch Hetchy and all these other assets to advance our economic resilience in the long term. But the truth is that we have been chipping away incrementally at this issue for a long time. I think the thing that we need to realize is that every day, everyone's afforded an opportunity to increase their capacity to be safer during times of stress. We offer in our construct that simply by throwing an annual block party and meeting your neighbors and learning how to organize them, set up food stations, come together around your garages, let everyone know each other and feel that they can trust each other to work together and solve problems. Just that simple task of pulling a permit for $175 and having a block party could save a dozen lives on your street with no other investment. So I think that it isn't always about money. It's about prioritization, and it's about being creative. And it's also recognizing that, you know, it's about building relationships rich in trust and reciprocity, not just between residents, but also between residents and their civic leaders. And I think that speaks to the larger mission of just good governance and civic engagement.
Mary, is the Bay Area, obviously we were one of the first to win this Rockefeller Award, are we thought of as a leader nationally in this kind of preparedness?
We absolutely are, not only nationally, but internationally. People come here from all over the world to understand what we're doing and to figure out, you know, what they can learn from it. So, yes, very much so. But that doesn't mean we should sit on our laurels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, we have done a lot incrementally, and we've had lots of good wake-up calls. We had 1906, we had 1989, we've had the Oakland Hills fire. You know, we've had some experiences that have pushed us to, you know, at the state level, have Caltrans do retrofitting of bridges, at East Bay MUD dealing with the water systems crossing the fault lines in the East Bay, Hetch Hetchy being repaired, BART being upgraded, freeways being repaired. So all of these sort of public civic efforts are hugely important, and they take leadership on the part of mayors and council members and board of supervisors. They take citizens who will vote for those bond issues. So it's in addition to that, you have to do things at your block level and know your community and your immediate neighbors, but you also have to have a kind of consciousness about being willing to say, yes, I'll support that bond mm-hmm. issue. Yes, I will vote for this because I think it really matters to our city.
Mm-hmm. Another part of this, Laura Tam from Spur, is that, you know, the Bay Area isn't just one government and one city. So I know Spur works across county lines. How do we get different local governments to work together to come up with a plan that works for everybody?
That's a good question. I mean, it's not always easy because local governments have land use authority and they do almost all the planning and permitting and zoning in their areas of jurisdiction for buildings. We do have some common threads that run throughout, like we have state building codes, we have certain safety standards that we all conform to, and we have some regional agencies of government that are thinking about the big picture, and particularly in where I work in sea level rise and water, especially, we have a lot of really thoughtful governance changes that I think are building upon the success of responding to previous disasters in the earthquake world are helping us prepare for climate change. So we have really good governance, ironically, in our water field, where we've got lots of different agencies now building connections between their water systems, specifically in case of a natural disaster and somebody's pipelines are totally ruptured. Now the East Bay can share water with the South Bay and the South Bay with San Francisco and other places. So we have the ability to share water across county lines in case of a disaster, either a drought or an earthquake. We also are doing that with sea level rise. We're talking about what can we do as a region to improve our regional shorelines and to think about how, you know, we have 500 miles of bay shoreline in the Bay Area. A lot of it is vulnerable to future sea level rise, but it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. So we have to work together to learn from each other. There are a ton of really exciting projects and experiments going on right now that will hopefully inform our progress in that area.
Daniel Holmesy from the Neighborhood Empowerment Network.
I just want to qualify and build on Mary's point that when we do have delegations come, and Mary and I actually work with delegations from Christchurch, New Zealand, have come here to see how they could rebuild their cities. I think one of the key takeaways that they tell me often is not what we've done, but the unrelenting commitment that the communities and their leadership have on this issue, realizing that we will never be as resilient or reach the condition that we basically all agree we need to, and that we've got to be, so committed to this forever. I think that's one of the things that
you never get to the point where you're like, we're good, we're all set.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's like how many more Super Bowls do the Niners want to win kind of a thing, right? So the point is that I offered that because it's very important, right, is that whenever we create like this sort of like benchmark finish line approach towards this this issue or any issue in our life, inevitably we will become more vulnerable and fail. And so the building standards that were in place in the 50s inherently were set against the 1906 earthquake and all these other events, and we built to those standards. Well, guess what? In the 70s, we realized they weren't good enough. So we reset the goal line again for building performance. But we actually have now, and I want to honor that the Chief Resilience Officer of City and County of San Francisco, Patrick Ottolini, has done a fantastic job advancing the CAPS project, the Community Action Plan for Seismic Safety, which Spur put out there, which is that, you know, the city is rich in building specifically soft story structures that we need to work with the owners of these properties and the residents of these communities to get them safe. And so, you know, again, like Mary said, we've done a great job, but certainly I think from the standard of the work to be done, I don't think anyone's sitting back at night and thinking the job's over.
Laura. Borrowing from the ecological field that Mary raised earlier, it's just like Daniel saying with respect to what we know and what we don't know, it's always going to be an evolution. Like the systems will always have to evolve. We're always going to learn more. And I keep coming back to environmental things because that's what I work on, but we've done a lot in the building code just in the last 10 years to evolve to new green building standards where our buildings are more efficient, they're more water and energy efficient, and they're much more resilient to environmental change. So I think we're going to have to keep moving. We'll always have work to do in this area.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing what it means to be a resilient city with my guests, Daniel Holmesy, director of the Neighborhood Empowerment Network, Mary Camario, professor of UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, and Laura Tam, sustainable development policy director at SPUR. We now invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. What does disaster resilience mean to you? Do you live in a neighborhood that has been affected by a natural disaster or by climate change? Do you feel prepared for the next earthquake, flood, or fire? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org. What other cities can we turn to learn, both in this country and around the world? What other cities are thought of to do a really good job in this area?
I would say locally, one city that I think does not get enough credit for their vision and leadership and, frankly, skin in the game is the city of Santa Cruz, California. And Charles Eady and the leadership that was shown in that community after 1989, I think, was overshadowed by the sort of San Francisco experience. But I think it's very clear for our listeners to know, 1989 was Santa Cruz's, you know, 1906 earthquake. It wasn't San Francisco's big event. And I think the fact that Santa Cruz was able to come together and, I think, recover quite quickly in a culturally competent way is a lesson for everyone in the Bay Area to learn from. And I think I just want to take a moment and honor that investment because I don't think they get enough credit for the work they did down there.
Also, I think we have to honor the city of Berkeley. They have just been really on the forefront of pushing things like a real estate transfer tax to help people retrofit their homes. And they have, you know, they've pushed for the school district to do work. They've been a leader in the Bay Area as well.
Yeah, sure. I would say that at least in terms of climate change and resilience planning, we're all kind of in this together. Everyone is starting to recognize what their vulnerabilities are and what they need to do to adapt. But to other places, I would look to places like Rotterdam, like New York, on sea level rise. I would look to places like Singapore and even our own South Bay on water resilience, where they've developed a plan for recycling wastewater and turning it into highly treated purified water. That's a model for the Bay Area as well, and we have it right here in our backyard. And Seattle has also done a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would. And then if we're expanding sort of like our Hall of Fame here, you know, I think, you know, and again, it comes down sometimes to, you know, when cities are confronted with this sort of sink or swim opportunity, like Greensburg, Kansas, that, you know, came back after its tornado and said, you know what, this town was really failing already. The young people weren't staying. We were already becoming just sort of basically a community of just people that were, you know, from a previous generation. And the mayor sat down with the young people in the town, the teenagers, and said, you know what? We want you to direct the recovery of this town because we want to build a city that you want to stay and live in. And that's the kind of like progressive thought leadership that more and more folks we need to have in that position realize, is that when you rebuild, don't build back what you had. Build back to achieve your goals that you had before, the new normal, right?
And what were some of the examples of ideas they got to how to build the town differently?
Well, I'll yield to my colleague here who's probably a better expert in this, but I will say that sustainability was a massive component of their program about building a city that lived in balance with the world and the community around it.
Yeah, they rebuilt their town to like lead platinum everything. And I don't remember all the details, but I did have the pleasure of listening to Bob Dixon, who was the mayor of the town, talk about the process of like grieving and stress that the community went through and emerged with like the building the greenest city from the ground up that exists anywhere in the Midwest and perhaps in the country. So it's actually a really lovely story for anyone who's interested. Just Google Greensburg, Kansas, mm-hmm. and read the story. It's mm-hmm. quite empowering, actually.
Yeah, I would. And then the communities surrounding Boulder that are bouncing back after the floods up there. Mm-hmm. Lyons is my own little favorite town that's doing some great work, too. So I would just I yield to Mary. But it's really hard not to fall in love with these communities when they sort of look, you know, failure in the eye and say,
Mary, anyone else we're overlooking?
Well, I think Cedar Rapids had a flood several years ago, and they really did a lot. It was a real public-private partnership between the businesses in town who continued to pay their employees during this crisis period so that they continued to have jobs and people stayed and didn't leave the town. And then there was a lot of sort of public involvement in the rebuilding. Also, I think we have to give a lot of credit to Christchurch, New Zealand. They have done a remarkable job in an incredible trying set of circumstances. I mean, they're not there yet. They're not out of the water. But they have, they've had, you know, multiple damaging earthquakes over several years. It wasn't just one. And they actually did a Cedar Rapids thing where the government funded payment for employees in businesses that were destroyed so that they had sort of 12 weeks to get on their feet. And there were a lot of efforts at sort of thinking about planning a greener city, thinking about building for the future that have been a part of what they've dealt with. And so those are important places.
Let's go to one of our callers. We have Mary calling in from Brisbane. Mary, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Yes, I had a question about tsunamis. It didn't seem to be high on the disaster list of your guests, but which is a relief, I guess. But I was wondering if in the geologic record there are any previous records of any previous tsunamis and if there are any protocols in place in the Bay Area for that.
Mary Camario from Berkeley.
Yeah, there are. The tsunami modeling does not suggest that we're going to be very badly hit in the Bay Area. I hope that's correct. It's not my field of expertise, but I think it will not be. It is not, according to the modeler, is supposed to be a very big deal here. There are other places on the California coast where it is much more significant, but the Bay Area is not, for whatever combination of the shape of the coast and the way the waves move, we're not as badly impacted.
Daniel Holmesy.
I would also say that just through being part of the community, that I know the Department of Emergency Management in San Francisco is working aggressively on a tsunami annex. You know, we do have assets that certainly we have to take in consideration. Treasure Island, the waterfront, the wraparound refraction effect. So I do know that the area takes this very seriously. They're developing a new tsunami warning evacuation strategy for the west side of San Francisco. So it may not get a lot of attention, but it is certainly something that we all took very seriously, especially after the earthquakes in Tohoku, Japan. We did see the activity come over here. Remember, the port in Santa Cruz had like $3 million in damage. We can't forget the tragedies of Crescent City up the coast. And so certainly, you know, we do have a history, current history of tsunami activity. It just isn't something that, based on the modeling, hits that threshold of day-to-day here in the Bay Area.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for your call. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing what it means to be a resilient city with my guests, Daniel Holmesy of the Neighborhood Empowerment Network, Mary Camario of UC Berkeley, and Laura Tam of Spur. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Again, the number to join to call our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website. And we do have an email that just came in from Paul who asks, what about landslides?
Mm-hmm. Landslides are very significant. There are there are areas in San Francisco and certainly areas in the whole region which are highly susceptible to landslides. They are mapped. You can find that out. You can go down to the city. You can go to the California Geological Survey and look up your property vis-a-vis landslide zones, also vis-a-vis liquefaction zones. And it's something I think we don't talk enough about, and it is very important. People buy property in the Bay Area, and they're just so anxious to get something, right? To buy a house, to get a condominium, that they don't think about the risks very much, mm-hmm. but it's a really important thing to think about whether or not you're buying a house in a in an area that it is susceptible, and it's important. I happen to live on a piece of very solid rock in San Francisco. I've lived in the same house for 35 years.
What neighborhood are you in?
I'm in it's the hill between Noe Valley and the Castro. Mm-hmm. And I must be the only spouse in San Francisco that says, honey, I like the soil conditions.
Mm-hmm. I think, it's a very good point. I mean, I was born and raised in the city in fourth generation. And, I remember the severe storms that we had in the 80s. And a friend of my family's house in Mill Valley was wiped out by a landslide. And, I mean, the entire building tumbled down a mountain with three people in it. And no one died. So it's a severe event. I actually, for the sake of this conversation, want to put out there that every once in a while, like a good Godzilla movie, right? Like, these things work in teams, right? So, for example, the sea level rise, there's some evidence that shows that as the sea level rise begins to occur, that water tables rise inland, therefore perhaps generating higher levels of liquefaction in areas that we hadn't anticipated before. So the 89 earthquake happened, 10 years from now. Would there be greater damage in the city because of the fact that the sea level rise had higher and maybe areas had higher water tables than previously? Or, for example,
certainly 1906, earthquake, and then fire.
Exactly. Or even the issue of, like, if we have a massive earthquake during the winter season when hillsides are more unstable and wetter. And so there could be the correlation of, intensity of climate change, intensity of storms, soil water composition, and then an earthquake strikes. And so in Mira Loma Park, one of the neighbors we work with, there is no liquefaction issue there, but there's a tremendous landslide issue. And that's what the neighborhood is talking about, is how do we look at the homes that are closest to these potential landslide areas and make sure to seek out and help those folks right away.
Laura from Spur.
Yeah, Daniel makes a good point, which is that all of these hazards and perils are different depending on where you are. And that's why it's so important to do hazard planning and figure out what to do as a homeowner, as a neighborhood, as a city, that are extremely local. And the impacts of climate change are the same in some ways. If you're in Boulder, Colorado, you don't have to worry about sea level rise. But in the Bay Area, we do. In parts of San Francisco, you don't have to worry about a landslide, but in some places you do. So there's a mix that everyone faces, and it's somewhat personal, and it's hyper local. And so we have to think about, there's every scale of government and planning is, and people's lives are implicated in trying to figure out how to plan and avoid these emergencies as best as possible to build resilience.
But I would add to that, Laura, you have to include where you work.
Right, of course.
Because, people spend a lot of their time in their workplace.
Yay.
And what are your conditions? How easy or hard will it be for you to reconnect with your family? I think that has to be part of the planning.
I mean, that's a very good point, David. I mean, I'd like, one of the things that's interesting right now that's happened is this, the earthquake in Napa. And I had someone come up to me and said, it's terrible what happened in Napa yesterday, but that doesn't help you with your work because of going out and people will be all motivated. And sadly, in a strange way, because an earthquake, the Napa earthquake happened at 3 in the morning, not 3 in the afternoon. Frankly, the narrative was almost like a 3-day story. I mean, like, oh, you can have a 6.9 earthquake and you get to go up the next day and everything's fine. The truth is, if that earthquake had happened at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I mean, just imagine all the tourists in the Barrel Wine facilities that would have been killed, all the people in downtown Napa that would have been crushed by the falling facades, i.e. Christchurch, New Zealand. That's what happened there. The people that are working the lines at the restaurant where the hot fryer was flying around and oil was going everywhere. And we could have had hundreds of people killed in Napa. And so timing is everything. And why that's important is because San Francisco's population doubles every day. Because of all the people that come and work in the city. And so when you talk about what the city is planning on addressing, just imagine if we're in the middle of tourist season, it's October, we have the Super Bowl, and we have an extra million people in the city and something like this strikes. Then it isn't just about caring for the residents that we know are on paper every day. We have another one or two cities on top of that that we've got to figure out how to support as well. And honestly, think about it. When you come to work in San Francisco every day, do you bring your kit? Do you bring, all the resources you need to care for yourself after an earthquake? Of course not. You're going to be looking to the city to support that. And so really, it's almost like one of those things like time, place, and location really is going to have a magnifying effect on the outputs.
So you've talked about some of the challenges facing the Bay Area. Obviously, we're a leader in a lot of ways, but what are the things we still need to do? Where are we most vulnerable? Where do we need to put our attention now?
Wow. There are a lot of things. I think we really need to work with the business community more. I think we haven't done enough of that, and they're a really important part of our community. They're still, you know, we have a plan for the soft story buildings. We're starting to work on those. It'll take us time to continue to sort of retrofit and upgrade buildings. There are older historic buildings that probably need more work. But I think we need to have the same kind of community conversations that Daniel has with his with neighborhoods, with the business community, and thinking about how they're going to handle it for their long-term survival as a company, but also, you know, for their employees. And how, what are they going to do with all those people who are in San Francisco and there's an earthquake? How do they plan to manage that? You know, how are those Google buses going to get up and down the freeway? I think that's a piece we haven't really talked to enough about.
Well, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, you know, the Bay Area and California as a whole, even if the earthquake is in San Francisco or Los Angeles, if it is as severe as some of the models show, it could, you know, set back the GDP of this country significantly. And I think that that's something that Mary's absolutely correct, is that we've got to talk. Here's the thing is, this is like, if you look at the business snapshot of 1970 in San Francisco, like, you know, Bank of America was based here, law firms were based here, this, this, and this. You know, there's a lot of embedded institutions, Fortune 500 companies based in San Francisco. All those companies are gone. Now we have a whole new class of companies that are here in the city, new leaders, new employees that work on a platform that's called the cloud, which, you know, is a fairly malleable entity that I guess you can work anywhere, anytime on, right? And so how do we keep those companies in San Francisco after a disaster like that, when there'll obviously be a lot of pressure on them to explore maybe going some other place? And I think having those conversations with them now and letting them know what our strategy are is to get the power back on, get the housing going, get the schools reopened, is going to increase their confidence to want to make those immediate decisions, which happen pretty quickly after disaster, feel confident about staying here, and feel like the local civic agencies have their back.
But we also want them to have a strategy. We want them to think about, how are they going to take care of their employees?
Oh, absolutely.
How are they going to organize their work? Who's, you know, can people share housing if some of their employees lose their housing? How could they could do that kind of thinking prior to a disaster? And businesses don't tend to do that, but it's a really important, it's a broader definition of business continuity than just getting the bank to work.
And for any corporate leaders who might be listening tonight, are there places they can go right now to get resources, online or otherwise?
Well, I mean, if most Fortune 500 companies and even, you know,
right, but say you're a little startup or what?
Well, yes, there are. So there are resources out there. You can contact organizations like SF Card in San Francisco, which focus on organizational resilience. They balance their investment from nonprofits and faith-based organizations, but they're available for you to provide technical support to you as a private sector actor as well. And there are actually cohorts of people that do business continuity planning that you can plug into as well. And it's a very good point about, you know, if you want to succeed during times of stress, you've got to make those investments now. I think that there are actually a lot of examples in the private sector, frankly, that government can learn from as well. The Gap, for example, has an incredible system to track the status of its employees anywhere in the world during times of stress. So does Salesforce. And so it's just really about leveling that playing field. And I'll close on the fact that, I guess for me, the big concern are small businesses, right? The folks that are like, mm-hmm. How are they going to make rent this month? How do they make payroll tomorrow? Often they are cash businesses, so they have no financial record to be eligible for FEMA. That's that small population, which may not seem significant, but 80% of the people who live in San Francisco are employed by small businesses, and they're the backbone of our local economies.
You mentioned the cloud earlier, and we're so reliant more and more every year on things in the cloud. What happens if everything goes down in any one of these types of emergencies? How do we handle that?
I can't speak to it with respect to the cloud, but from an infrastructurist perspective, in terms of thinking about what happens, I think it's really important for planners, and we have done some of this at Spur, to do some scenario planning for potential futures. Like, for example, in some transportation work that we did, we we asked, what happens if the BART tunnel is down and the Bay Bridge is down? How do we move people between San Francisco and the East Bay?
Because right. so many of our first responders also live outside of the city.
Exactly.
So how are we going to get them into the city to help?
And by thinking through the ways that a disaster could unfold, and this is probably true for the cloud too, by thinking through the ways that it could unfold, you can think about how to meet those needs. You know what your needs are and you know how to meet them. I wanted to say also, like from an infrastructurist perspective, with respect to the climate change disasters, which we have a little bit more time to plan for, I hope and think, relative to the disaster of an earthquake that we're expecting, is that we have some time to take a more thoughtful approach. I think we need one of our biggest challenges is how long it takes to build things. We've been working on rebuilding San Francisco's water system since 2002. We're close, but we're not done. It took us 24 years to rebuild the Bay Bridge after it collapsed in the middle of the World Series. So certainly the world's attention was on us at the time, and it was a terrible but well-known disaster, and it still took us a long time. We also need funding and perhaps even, I would say, a regulatory push to understand and be able to experiment with not only the scenario planning for a sudden disaster, but what do you do about various types of shoreline that need to be retrofit to prepare for sea level rise? What do you do to help build grid-resilient communities that can create their own energy and use it during the time of an energy shortage or a disaster? So I think we have to experiment with a lot more sort of pilot projects towards resilience, and that's going to take some funding and some leadership.
I do want to point out that you talk about innovation and what the Bay Area is doing, and specifically what San Francisco is doing, is as a result of Mayor Lee's leadership on the work, and he personally toured the neighborhoods of New Orleans after Katrina and sort of came back with a ton of ideas, a lot of it fueled by the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and their Acting in Time initiative, which some of our local actors like Ariel Chacos from the ABAG and Doug Allers drove. One of the key outcomes that came in addition to the program I run was the Lifelines Council. And so San Francisco is one of the few cities in America that actually has a Lifelines Council, which brings together telecom, power, all these folks, and has actually, in an amazingly short amount of time, ironed out a ton of interoperability issues and ways to advance investment. Example being, everyone's like saying we need gasoline to fuel the police and the fire vehicles, right? Well, all of a sudden, you find out that the power company is at a priority to get energy to the gas stations because we didn't know that. And so you see that just these early conversations about what the response strategy can be and then connecting back to the lifelines is going to make a huge difference. And frankly, anecdotally, that was a big problem in New York City during Sandy, was the fact that the lifeline service providers didn't have that connectivity about what the goal and strategy were during the post-event.
Let's take a final station break and then come back and talk some more. We're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing what it means to be a resilient city with my guests, Daniel Holmesy from the Neighborhood Empowerment Network, Mary Camario from UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, and Laura Tam from SPUR. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. What does disaster resilience mean to you? Do you feel prepared for the next earthquake, flood, or fire? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website at klw.org. Let's now go to the phones. We have a call from Buster in San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I was wondering about if you've been talking to law enforcement, because I'm thinking of, civil disorder and what cities, including smaller cities that don't have a lot of law enforcement, would do to avoid panic and violence after a disaster. I mean, where I live, I know some neighbors have guns and some don't, and if this happened in the middle of the night where massive loss of power and people couldn't see anything, I mean, there could be real chaos. I'm just wondering if you've worked with them and what your best case and worst case scenarios might be in that circumstance.
Daniel Holmesy from the Neighborhood Empowerment Network. How is the city working with law enforcement on these issues?
Great. And I just want to baseline that the Neighborhood Empowerment Network is actually a program out of the city administrator's office for the city and county of San Francisco, Naomi Kelly's office. So I just want to honor the fact that I do work for the city and honored and blessed to do so. It's a very interesting conversation. This is very common for this sort of like the perception of sort of civil unrest and violence after a disaster. In 1989, for example, when I had to go across town and help someone who was in a building they needed to get out of, I had to go through a neighborhood that, frankly, I was a little nervous about going through just because it wasn't traditionally one of the safer neighborhoods. And when I got there, the very people that I normally would be concerned about were actually directing traffic and helping people. And I think we saw that in Oakland as well, in the Cypress Structure collapse, as the people rose up and the best came out. And I think a paradise built in hell narrative, Rebecca Solnit's book, articulates this very well. I think what we need to do is that's why we need to get in neighborhoods today and talk about how these organizations and institutions, in the Bayview, for example, you know, we have faith-based leaders, nonprofit leaders, we have merchants all coming together talking about how they're going to work together to respond during times of stress and create a really stable civic environment. Why that's important is because if there's order, if resources are being distributed equitably, if people feel like there is some semblance of governance at the local level, they'll behave accordingly. But if it's just basically a total absence of any type of sort of civic engagement, that may not be the case. And so I do feel that there's a tremendous amount of investment to right on the public safety side to be prepared for that moment. But I do think in the end, the ethos and values of those communities are going to drive behavior pre and post event. And I think those values are heading in the right direction right here in San Francisco. And I feel very confident that we'll rise to the occasion as we've done in the past.
Thank you very much for your call, Buster. Let's now go to Ken in San Francisco. Ken, welcome to City Visions.
Wow, that last line sounded like it came right out of a mayor's office press release. Pretty good, Dan. Anyway, I had a good question from a lady who runs the seniors home. There is plans for 72hours.org for the city, you know, post-disaster, like an earthquake. But as the manager asked me, what about after 72 hours? What does she do with all her seniors who aren't ambulatory? I really couldn't find an answer for her. So what would happen after 72 hours? You can imagine water is still out, et cetera, power, all kinds of things, not to mention health care. Any ideas on that?
Okay, so day four, who can help Ken with an answer to that question?
I guess I can handle that since I work with these agencies. So the truth is that we do have a strategy for day one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, and going after a disaster. We have a whole team dedicated to the Department of Health that's doing fantastic work in right now identifying all the locations where vulnerable residents live in the city, working with the agencies that manage a lot of those central care facilities, and coming up with a very specific strategy to make sure that those residents don't experience any unnecessary stress during that time. Of course, the threshold of performance is tied to the size of the event. But the bottom line is that, you know, I'm working with folks like Terry Dowling and Novena Baba at the Department of Health. I mean, that's all they talk about and think about all the time. And there's some really great progressive work. But again, I want to point out that that's part of the parallel work we're trying to do with the neighborhood is that building manager that has those residents in there is going to need the help of the local nonprofits and the local faith-based organizations immediately and ongoing to care for those folks. And so we want to take a tiered approach and say, you know, what can that property manager do? What can the city do? But what can the neighborhood do as well to make those residents feel safe during that period? So that is a top line priority for the city right now.
Let's go to thank you very much, Ken, for your call. We have an email from Michelle who asks, why doesn't San Francisco have as many earthquake drills as Japan?
We have one every year.
Well, we do
does
have.
Does anyone know? Does Japan have them more frequently?
Well, I would say there are different types of drills. And so I think that's one thing is in Japan, they have this massive civilian defense corps and and so the, and due to their 2,000-year history of earthquakes, it's very much part of their culture. I would offer that, you know, let's define drill, right? So every time your building has an evacuation drill, that's a form of an earthquake drill. And the schools do that. Businesses do it all the time. We do have the annual shakeout drill where we drop, cover, and hold. And that does help. And does advance the ethos and values of a drill. And so I think that we do adequately drill every day in our own way. And so I think it is, you know, it is something that is front and center, I think, on a lot of people's vision.
And there are actually other drills that maybe the public doesn't see. I mean, the University of California runs a series of different scenario drills, and sometimes they involve the staff and students, but sometimes they're just the leadership. So, you know, we might ask the chancellor's cabinet to think about a scenario in which they're in day two after an earthquake and this much has happened and they have to decide whether or not to close the institution. I mean, it's the kind of a scenario exercise that goes on in the background that people don't see every day, but there are. And I think the city does this, the police department does it, the emergency preparedness folks do it. So there's a lot of these other drills that are going on among the people whose job it is to pay attention
And we did that huge drill last year in the Tenderloin where we brought St. Anthony's Dining Room together and we fed 3,000 people to test the ability to do a mass feeding in the Tenderloin. I also want to put out there's a whole layer of testing and drilling that happens at the professional level all the time and annually, year-round. There's tons of drills and exercises that go on within the city, within the Bay Area and all the actors and actually working with the federal government. During Fleet Week, there's a lot of investment in talking about how the U.S. military will be a resource to this area during times of stress, especially for San Francisco. Let's face it, water is going to be a very important platform to get us resources. We want to see ships coming in this area with supplies because that's going to be a major way to get San Francisco resources. So I think there's a lot of tiered drilling and exercising that's going on. And I would just offer this year in the Bayview, they're going to do their first community drill activation in the fall around how they're going to work together to do a lot of that work on their own with their local partners. And we're excited to help them advance that that test.
I want to talk about the chief resiliency officer and just understand where that person fits in city government, because, Daniel, you're part of the city world. You already talked about the Department of Public Health. There's the Department of the Environment. Is the chief resiliency officer partly trying to coordinate all these different departments to work together? And if not, can you kind of define that role a little more?
Absolutely. So the chief resilience officer for the city and county of San Francisco, Patrick Ottolini, who's a well-known actor in this space, and either Mary and folks all know him very well. He's very much in the position where he reports to the mayor and the city administrator. And his role is right now to really just sort of do a huge inventorying of where we are as a city in this work. And I assure you, I've seen some of the spreadsheets. There are literally hundreds of programs that could be tied to resilience that are happening right now. Right now, what Patrick's doing, and I attended one of the meetings today, is bringing the people together from all sectors and actually joining in a conversation about what are our collective goals and priorities for preparing our communities, for building better neighborhoods, for building better homes, and how can we work together to achieve them. The next round, of course, I think is to begin to advance a plan, but really an action plan of like how we can not just what can we do to move the needle on what we're doing well right now, but what aren't we doing that we can put more energy into? And so Patrick's getting fantastic technical support from the Resilient Cities Initiative. And what's neat about his role, we were talking about that the other day, is that he's also talking to chief resilience officers all over the world. And I think that's really a powerful opportunity that the network that they're creating has. There is a chief resilience officer in Wellington, Christchurch, you know, New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C. They're all over the place. Actually, not Washington, D.C., but Dallas. And New Orleans and places like that. And so now this maybe will create a better network for us to share and bring that real-time awareness and knowledge of best practices. And we're already seeing the impact and benefits happening here in San Francisco. So it's a very exciting time.
Laura.
Yeah, as part of the Resilient SF Steering Committee and working with Patrick, I can attest that they've got a long list of things that touch on the topic of resilience. But one of the things that I think that Patrick and his team are doing that's really exciting is potentially addressing those areas of resilience that fall to not any one particular agency in government,
right,
but really are a cross-cutting, massive problem that needs to be resolved by many coming together. And so I think he has that sort of convening power to sort of get everybody talking about a particular issue. And one that I know that he's gone on record about is the Embarcadero seawall, which is very important for protecting all of downtown San Francisco and lots of other places behind it from flooding, but is also getting old and is vulnerable to earthquakes as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're certainly very fortunate to have that position, thanks to the Rockefeller Foundation here in the Bay Area. We just have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask each of you to talk about a myth or misconception about disaster preparedness that you'd like to dispel. This is your opportunity to let the public know things they might believe that they shouldn't.
Well, I had one of them we already talked about, which is the fact that Alameda County and San Francisco County are some of the most heat vulnerable places in the entire U.S. And you wouldn't think that because you think we have a lot of fog and we have a cool climate, Mediterranean climate. But in fact, we're subject to these heat waves that our buildings nor our bodies are really prepared for. So that's one of them. The other one is that I sometimes am guilty of saying this even, is that climate change is the problem of the future. But actually, it's a problem of today. We're learning more and more that potentially that timeline is accelerated even forward towards today, and we have to deal with potentially long-term droughts. We also have, by the way, many, many millions of more people moving to the Bay Area and to California who are all going to be potentially impacted by if we don't plan for a system to change and grow over time. I'm thinking specifically of our water system, which was built 40 years ago, 60 years ago, or 100 years ago, not really ready for 25 million new Californians. So we have to, there are lots of areas in which we have to potentially speed up the rate at which we're planning for right now. And sea level rise is another one. We tend to think, and studies have shown increasingly, that's going to happen faster than we thought when this came on the radar 10, 15 years ago. We definitely have to plan for at least a foot of sea level rise by mid-century, 3 feet by the end of the century, and I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers are greater 5 years from now.
I think for me, just building on the myth of preparedness, right, and I think the truth is that to some extent, you know, when we talk about these massive earthquakes, it's a little intimidating, overwhelming. Like, what can I possibly do in the face of a period like that? The truth is a lot. There's a lot you can do. Really simple, small things you can do to yourself, for your family, for your house, and for the community around you. And I guess for me, it's sometimes put in a place where, like, the fear-based messaging that's been used around preparedness for a long time, they know just sort of has really alienated a lot of people. So we're trying to put a pin on that. SF72 is a great website you can go to here in San Francisco and see the positive side about connection, the power of being part of your community. And I want to save time for Mary, but I will tell you that for me right now, when people say, what can I do to prepare my neighborhood for a disaster? I'm like, throw a block party. You know, meet your neighbors, build relationships, trust, and reciprocity. I mean, in New Orleans, the community fell back not on neighborhood associations to rebuild their neighborhoods, but the dance troops that put on the floats and the parades. That was the number one civic platform that helped drive recovery in New Orleans. So celebrate your community, celebrate each other, take the time to say hello. That isn't a lot of work, and it's actually a lot of fun in more ways than you can ever imagine.
Okay, listeners, Daniel Holmes, he says go out and party. Mary, you get the last word.
On a more sour note, FEMA is not a national 911. You know, you cannot just say, I don't have to do anything because, well, it'll happen and FEMA's going to take care of it. FEMA is not going to take care of it for you. The national government is there to help the locals coordinate. It is not there to help you fix your house. And you really do have to not only go out and party and meet your neighbors, but you also have to think about what your plan is and think about whether or not you need to retrofit your house and think about a little bit of investment that will save you a lot of grief in the long time.
Amen. Like the Bolt Embrace program, which is rolling out in parts of San Francisco right now. Yeah. Bolt Embrace, check it out.
Okay, that's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Daniel Holmesy, Director of the Neighborhood Empowerment Network, Mary Camario, Professor at UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, and Laura Tam, Sustainable Development Policy Director at SPUR. Thank you all so much for joining us this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Sarah Stotter. City Visions is off next Monday for Martin Luther King Day. Join me the following week as we make sense of conflicting recommendations for vitamins and supplements. I'm David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great couple of weeks.